Hi, this is Nathan Crane, and I'm very excited to have you join us today for the Earth Day Summit. This summit is dedicated to bringing you inspiring insights and practical approaches rooted in wholeness to empower each of us with real solutions for activating the experience of global consciousness. And today I'm happy to introduce our speaker, Elizabeth Satoris. Dr. Elizabeth Satoris is an evolution biologist, futurist, professor, author, and consultant on living systems design. She shows the relevance of biological systems to organizational design in business, government, and globalization. She's a fellow of the World Business Academy, an advisor to ethicalmarkets.com, and the Masters in Business program at Schumacher College. Dr. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a delight to be with you.
Wonderful. Well, we're going to dive right in. I want to get right into this subject because I know you have a lot of wonderful things to share, and it's very intriguing. You talk about nature's maturation cycle. What has your research shown you of how that cycle works and maybe what it looks like?
Well, you know, I became an evolution biologist because studying evolution of Earth, that's almost 4 billion years of experience that our beautiful planet has, that's really giving you a very deep groundedness in Earth and a very makes you a deep pastist. My real goal was to become a futurist, and if you're a good pastist, you have a better sense of where you can go in the future. Now, when I went into science, I was going on the premise that science was the study of nature for the purpose of guiding human affairs, which was the original Greek idea behind science. They had called it philos sophias. We turned that into philosophy, and it was natural philosophy first, and then it got kind of abandoned as in terms of science as a separate a separate field. We separated philosophy from science, and I think that was a mistake. But anyway, it didn't turn out that way when I studied science. They were much more interested in details than in broad, big-picture thinking. And this program today is about wholeness and about understanding our situation so that we can find solutions. So I basically had to go through evolution again by myself, taking everything that was known in science and trying to put it together for myself. I did most of that work on a small Greek island that was forested and where I could walk daily and ask nature, was I on the right track as I tried to put this together? And the biggest thing I discovered was exactly what you just asked me about, that maturation cycle. What I discovered was that from the very first bacteria up to us, all of life has been going through a maturation cycle over and over that's kind of like what we go through in our individual lives, where we have a youthful time that's creative and expansive, and we gather resources and then we multiply. And then eventually, we have to come together in a cooperative, mature way to become good citizens, right? We expect our adolescents to be feisty and competitive and, you know, playing all those wonderful ball games and things. And then we expect them to become mature citizens that are in service to community. And your body expanded its economy, and I call it an economy because it is one. Up until about adolescence, and then you had to stop growing and level off, right? So the maturation cycle goes like this. A unity individuates, like the early Earth crust individuating into bacteria, or a baby born from a mother, or there are a gazillion examples. And when you have individuals, they compete with each other because each of them has somewhat different self-interests, and it just naturally turns into a competitive, creative phase for getting along in the world. And then eventually it becomes too expensive to keep up the competitions. I like to say it's cheaper to feed your enemies than to kill them off. That is the big lesson in evolution. That is the tipping point where species move from the feisty competitive adolescence into mature cooperation. And everybody kind of senses now that we have to get out of our competitive world, our win-lose world, into a win-win-learn world. So the beauty of the maturation cycle for us is that we're right at that tipping point where we're moving from the hostilities to the harmonies.
Yeah, I see that happening everywhere, really. I just had a great conversation with Andrew Harvey. We just did an interview for the Earth Day Summit. And one of the seven, what he calls spiritual laws that he talks about, the seventh one is about collaboration. It's about, you know, learning to work together in harmony. And I shared a story about that. But I fully agree and think what you're talking about is a critical tipping point for us, is to move beyond that old paradigm of competitive thinking into the, we could say, new paradigm of collaboration. I mean, if we observe nature, nature works in collaboration in so many ways. It's not the competitive thing that we used to think with the Darwinian theory that everything's competing against itself. If you ever study permaculture, or you spend time growing food or developing food forests or work, you know, spending a lot of time in nature, you come to see very quickly that everything does find a way to work together in perfect harmony. And I love that you're saying that that's the time we're at. I think that's very, very hopeful.
Yes, you know, you pointed out that very clearly. The Darwinian theory, you see, was adopted by our entire culture. And Darwin's theory fits the youthful mode very well, but it doesn't explain the mature collaborative mode. And it's interesting how science got politicized on both sides of the Iron Curtain, especially during the Cold War, you know, all those years, where while we were teaching Darwinism, because the capitalist entrepreneurs loved it, it gave them license to exploit and compete, you know, and work for profits and make lots of money. And in the Soviet Union, they wanted everybody to sort of sacrifice that kind of individual interest to community. So they promoted a view of evolution that was about cooperation, citing instead of Darwin, Kropotkin, whose book was called Mutual Aid. And so what I discovered was that once you see this maturation cycle, you see past the Darwinism, you see that both sides had half the picture. You know, the capitalist West had the youthful, expansive mode, and the communist East had move your selfishness into self-interest within community, you know, the collaboration side. So we have to forget our hostilities and put the whole thing together, think wholeness, as is the theme for today, and let our Mother Earth teach us the way.
So beautifully said. It reminds me of a friend of mine, Jacqueline Freeman. She's a biodynamic beekeeper who is a very wonderful author as well. And one of her observations with the bees, how she explains it is, you know, humans, we come out into this individualized experience. We, you know, learn about who we are and create identities with ourselves and go out into the world and do our individual things. And then, you know, we return back. You know, the whole kind of progress we make here is returning back to our unity, our unification, our oneness, kind of that return cycle, the sage cycle, the Buddhahood, the Christhood, etc. Whereas she explains the bees, they are born into unity consciousness. And so, like a bee, for example, there can be 10,000 bees flying all around each other and looks like complete chaos, yet not a single bee touches each other. They're in perfect harmony and they know exactly what they're doing and where they're going. They can flutter their wings and tell them the destination of a tree with pollen a mile away, and they're already born into this perfect harmony. It's unification. So they don't know the individualization, which I think is quite an interesting metaphor to think about.
Well, it's very like our bodies. Our bodies are highly evolved cooperatives of 100 trillion cells, each of which is as complex as a large human city. And while they don't fly non-touching like bees, but are in fact touching, 100 trillion of them have to know what each other are doing in order for it to work, and have to keep negotiating to make sure that in this hugely complex economy, way more complex than our whole global human economy is, they have to know what each other are doing too. I like to distinguish between communion and communication. Communication is when we have language, whether it's a symbolic language or a verbal language or an action language, whatever it is, that is a kind of external communication way. And then there's also the internal communion, which is the direct transmission of information, the kind of thing that you recognize as working when you understand the Eastern practices that you also mentioned. So our bodies can teach us everything we need to know about how to do a cooperative, collaborative economy. You know, no organ in your body tries to get the other one to be like it. You know, your liver is not trying to get your heart to be like a liver. And, you know, it understands diversity, the body. And if part of the body is injured, nobody protests when resources are sent to that injured part. You know, it knows that the individual can thrive only when its community is thriving as well. And so, you know, we in the West sacrificed community to the individual, while the Soviet Union sacrificed the individual to community, and we have to stop doing that. We don't need these sacrifices anymore. We can do well at the individual and the community level. And that's
right.
That's how our body works, you know. It's the most amazing economy. By the way, you know, every one of your cells has, on average, 1,000 banks giving out free money 24/7, where the bankers, the mitochondria, who way back when were free-living bacteria, they still have their own DNA in your cells, and they give out the stored value debit cards we call ATP, adenosine triphosphate, which is what galvanizes all of the activity in the cell. Everything is greased by that currency flow. But the mitochondria have to regulate how much of it is in circulation to make sure you don't have inflation or deflation. So when you've spent your debit card limit and take it back to the bank, you don't owe anything. They're just going to give you more money, but it may be less than you got last time, maybe more, depending on what the economy needs. So it's about need, not greed. And living systems, I mean, amazing, the technology. You also have 30,000 recycling centers in each of your 100 trillion cells that are the equivalent of putting a dead tree in a chipper machine and getting a live tree at the other end. That's where the proteins. And how are the proteins that need recycling identified, whether they're dead or whether they're ill or whether they're just not needed now and you want to remake them into something else? You know, this is such a highly intelligent system. I can waffle on forever. You may have other questions.
It's quite intriguing, and it is an incredibly brilliant system that we still don't fully understand because it works.
And we're all
so
walking
many
around in them, right? We're all walking around in them regardless of our political persuasions. So we have that in common, these bodies.
Now let's talk a little bit about living systems. You wrote a book a number of years ago called Earth Dance, Living Systems and Evolution. And I've come to realize the last maybe 7 or 8 years or so that everything in the universe, from the macro to the micro, is a part of some kind of system. Systems define everything, which explains why we as human beings love systems, you know, whether they're conscious or unconscious. So maybe you can talk a little bit about Earth Dance and you know, why you chose the title, and maybe explain some of the living systems that you're referring to.
Yeah, well, systems are obviously about relationships, and science, it silos everything, and it studies individual bits and pieces of nature, but it had trouble with big picture thinking and putting together the systems of nature, trying to analyze them, and when it does analyze them, it tends to see them in terms of engineering diagrams and stuff, like that. So living systems are very different from machinery, and yet science used the metaphor of machinery, and I talk about that in the Earth Dance book, and also in its sort of simpler version that's also updated called Gaia's Dance now. And that mechanical, Gaia's Dance is only an ebook right now, but I will get it into print eventually, but it's, you know, really inexpensive on Kindle, Amazon. The difference between the mechanical metaphor that science adopted and the life metaphors that I like to use, including dance, and I chose dance in both Earth Dance and Gaia's Dance, because dance is the one art form where the dancer is the dance. There is no separation. And that seemed to me the perfect metaphor, that Earth was like an improvisational dance that's always conserves the steps that work well and changes the steps that don't work well anymore, so that it's continually in evolution, but the conservation and the radical change are in harmony and always up for particular situations. So I like to say, you know, our democracy will never work until we get that the job division between protecting what works and changing what doesn't, which you can translate into Republicans and Democrats, can never work until we see that as a cooperative working together. And, you know, I think multiple parties are good that way, because some people are more inclined to wanting to protect things, you know, like national parks or whatever is working well, if the education system is working well, to do that. And other people are more inclined to say, oh, I love changing things, that, you know, I like the puzzles and finding the solutions and stuff like that. And right now, we're in such a critical mode that more and more of us have to go into the solutions mode, which is also part of our theme today, isn't it? So anyway, that's Earth Dance was about looking at that improvisational dance of 3.8 billion years, almost 4 billion, where half of it is bacteria. And when we look closely at what we now know about the ancient bacteria, they pioneered everything in our modern world, even things like electric motors that the nanotechnologists are trying desperately to recreate. But as machinery, it's harder to do it, and as our kind of machinery, rather than the living machinery, the living economies of nature. The simplest way to understand the difference between a mechanism and an organism is to think of the fact that when you walk away from your computer, you hope it does not change while you're gone, because they're not noted for improving themselves in your absence, unless some program is running overnight that you have set in motion. But if you walk away from a friend, you hope they do keep changing, because if they're not changing continually, they're dead, right? So the difference is that life is programmed from the inside. It grows itself. It repairs itself. It changes its ways. All of those things that with a machine, there has to be the external inventor or engineer to design it, to build it, to keep it going, and to think of new ways of improving it that we then call generations in one of the few living metaphors used by science. We talk about computer generations, knowing that they don't give birth to each other. So anyway, that it's very important to understand this difference between mechanism and organism because, for example, all of our social institutions have been designed to work like well-oiled machines. Whether they were in the communist East or the capitalist West, that was the common idea, that we have to figure out how to make society run like a well-oiled machine. And as a result, we stuffed everybody in boxes in those engineering diagrams, and we ran our schools and our businesses and our government and everything as if it was a machine. And that cripples life. So now you see the millennials saying, nope, you're not going to stuff me into one of those little boxes. I want to work on flex time. I'm going to call my own hours. I want a life besides my work life. You know, they're on the right track. They're on the right track because they're working on living economies rather than mechanical economies.
Yeah, beautiful. And we do see that happening more and more. With the youth, and I think it's important. And we see organizations being formed that are creating new systems and new cultures within their organizations that support that more creative kind of freeing experiential work life. And then you see those organizations thriving because people are happy to go to work and have diverse hours and different activities and different experiences and so forth that make it fun and creative. I think that's a really good point that you covered. You also briefly touched on the systems of governance, specifically democracy. And I'm curious as to where you see democracy going in the future.
Well, I don't know what we're going to call it in the future, whether we will hold on to democracy. You know, it means rule by the people, so it's a pretty good name. Right now, it's being crippled, as we know. We have one party kind of holding up everything in the government, and, claiming to work according to the Constitution, but not doing so. And we have huge, enormous problems in the country, and we see both sides, the Democrats and Republicans, getting the biggest voter turnouts for the people who most look like they want to really make this work for the people. I talk to my grandchildren, and they say they were never interested in politics before, but now they find candidates who are actually giving voice to the things that they realize are going wrong without knowing a lot of the history behind why they're, you know, why do we have the 99.1% split in our country? Well, you know, if you knew history, you'd know that that's not so new, that we've had waves of something closer to democracy, but we've never really done democracy yet. So if the millennials really get out there and take part in a democracy. You know, you cannot have rule of the people if the people aren't participating. And so Donald Trump is getting a lot of voters out. That is a good thing. That part of it is good. And Bernie Sanders is getting numbers that nobody would have dreamed possible because new people and especially the young people are getting out and saying somebody's voicing our complaints, you know, and let's get behind him. So we're having, it's a very, very interesting thing. Part of it is embarrassing. You know, I have long called what they do in Washington during campaigns caca poo-poo talk, as if they're five-year-olds slamming each other. You know, that part of it is very embarrassing, especially if you're a global citizen and you know what that looks like to the rest of the world. But we have
that's the best definition I've ever heard of.
You know, I thought it up long ago, right now it's rampant. I think this is the greatest challenge in human history. I think we humans are up for it. We're sailing through a perfect storm of crises now between the global warming, which there is no way to stop technologically, so we're going to have to adapt. We can adapt, but we have to do so with clean, green ways. I'm sitting here in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, the most remote occupied landmass in the whole world in Hawaii, and you know, we are working on island economy. We've got all the worst things that are happening on the continent, as we call it. We don't like to think of you all as the mainland while we're something lesser. So we call it the continent. I like that. We're working in my business school where I am at Chaminade University on building new courses for island economies that are rooted in the values of the ancient Hawaiians. And by the way, the word aloha embodies all the basic values of community and caring and sharing and respecting and all of those, that the land and each other, all of that is there. And we have a state law on the books that all business people, and in fact all people, must respect the law of aloha in Hawaii. And if that were the case, if everybody were abiding by that law, we wouldn't have any problems at all. Yet we have all the problems that everyone does in the world now. So we're trying to design new courses in the MBA program, or we're not trying, we're doing it. and I'm working on a wonderful team that's half Native Hawaiian, and to design courses in which young people go into business not to figure out how to make more money, but how to serve their community, how to leave a world to their grandchildren that they are proud to leave to them, how to practice these caring and sharing values. And I like to say to all young people, you know, you want the better future? Just start living it now. Treat people the way you want people to treat each other in the future. Take care of your body the way you think people should to keep it healthy. And by the way, that means feeding your gut bacteria their favorite foods like green smoothies and stuff, because they're running 80% of your immune system, as we now know. More news from Earth, right? And then live the way you think people should live and treat each other and themselves, and then look at the things your elders did that you don't like. If you don't think we should be spending money on wars and continuing to try to bump off enemies instead of feeding them and making friends of them, then just don't do it anymore. Way back in the 60s, we had a slogan called, what if they called a war and nobody came? And that still should be up there. The only reason young people go to war nowadays is because it's the only way to get a job in almost all the cases that go. Not too many are really out here wanting to go out and kill other people. And not too many young people really believe that the biggest threat we're facing is other people from outside our countries. A military man wrote a wonderful book, I wish I could remember his name, on how to stop ISIS. And it was go in there and make the lives of those young recruits better where they live. Improve their living conditions. You know, during the Vietnam War, we used to say, why don't they just buy Vietnam acre by acre and develop it instead of spending more money than it would take to do that on destroying the people in the land? We don't want to go into the future doing things like that, and we don't have to. And we'll save enormous amounts of resources if we don't do that. And who better to be the role model for the world than the one country that claims to be doing democracy and isn't? So we need to do democracy. We need to role model to the world genuinely, but we need to role model genuinely mature behavior. So one generation could turn this around. It could happen that fast.
And that's very hopeful and very very promising, because there is a whole group of people who are waking up to this new reality. I mean, I was just in Costa Rica, and, you know, there's a great example right there, a country without an army. Mm-hmm. The president mm-hmm. was smart enough in 1949 to abolish the army. He said, look, we don't need an army, we don't need a military, let's get rid of it and put that money into health care and education. So they did, and now education is basically free for everybody, health care is basically free for everybody. There's still a private sector, you know, their health care system isn't without its challenges and imperfections, and same thing with the education system, but it's there and it's available and it's working. And the thing that really astonished me was since they've abolished the army in 49, you know, they're really close with the United States. They, you know, there's support there and so forth, but they've had no need for any kind of military intervention since they abolished their military in 1949, that's over 60 years without a need for an army. I mean, that is incredible. I think it was Foster Gamble, who I did an interview with also here for the Earth Day Summit, who spoke about if we were to simply cut the United States military budget just in half, it would still be the largest military budget in the world, which is hard to think of if it's cut in half, but yet we could reallocate those resources to things like sustainable development and, you know, food growing and education and healthcare, and we would solve much of the country's deficit. So, you know, that it's moving beyond that competitive mindset. But like you said, it's really up to each one of us to really get involved, to voice our opinions, to connect with other people and say, look, what can we do about it? What choices can we make? What things can we do differently to make a difference? And there's a lot. There's a lot of things that each of us can do. But I want to remind people, we are talking with Dr. Elizabeth Satoris. Her website is www.satoris.com. It's SAHTORIS.com. And this is the Earth Day Summit. If you missed any of the previous interviews and you'd like to own all of them, plus some special additions, and you'd like to listen to these again and again, there is an option. The Shift Network has provided an option for you to own the interviews. It's earthdaysummit.com/upgrade, and all the details should be there for you. And finally, if you're interested in really embodying everything we're speaking about, learning to live in unity with your fellow human beings, learning to live unified with the planet, and learning to develop new skills for building the new world, then I invite you to Unify Fest. It's September in Santa Fe. It's unifyfest.com. And Dr. Elizabeth, to kind of finalize our discussion here, this has been really wonderful, and I thank you. And I'm just wondering, what final words of hope or encouragement would you leave all of us with?
Yeah, well, we humans have been through a dozen ice ages. We've never been through a hot age, which is what we're facing now. But a hot age is only as much hotter as an ice age was colder than what we consider normal. And that's a, 6 to 8 degree temperature, lower or higher. And right now there are as many people living in deserts on the planet, on our beautiful Earth, as there are in the whole of Europe. The entire European population is about the size of all the people living in deserts now. So we know it can be done. We can adapt. I went to Morocco years ago to see how they lived really comfortably in deserts and produced enough food and had enough water and all those things. So I know it can be done. So I think we should stop wasting our time trying to stop the Earth from the fever we gave it and adapt and keep things healthy as we go. We're going to face huge crises. And in order to make a better world, it takes many, many people doing many, many things. I was invited to a boom festival in Portugal 2 years ago. They do them every other year. That's sort of the European version of Burning Man, except instead of everyone in SUVs, they don't allow any vehicles in, and the organizers come in 6 months early to build hundreds of composting toilets and setting up permaculture gardens that are fed by the poo from the toilets and recycling the gray water through reed beds into the little lake on the desert property that it's done in Portugal. Look up Boom Festival, B-O-O-M. We're going to have far more refugees from climate than we're having from Syria, which is already a disaster, a disastrous problem for Europe. So people like this who know how to build infrastructure where there is none in natural ways are going to be the experts in the near future. When the sea level rises, it won't go up an inch at a time. It'll go up possibly up to a few meters at a time, according to Jim Hansen, our best expert in the U.S. So everyone find the way that makes your heart sing to be a world change agent. Whether you want to write songs and sing them, or whether you want to grow the food, grow the gardens, or work in medical research of natural means of healing, or whether you want to get into politics, just find what makes your heart sing so that you will become an attractor to others as you do it, so that you can work through these crises, navigate with joy and enthusiasm, and realize that that hero's journey that helped us with the expansion economy did not give us the next story for what happens when the hero comes home with all his experience. When you take all of your experience and want to build a wisdom economy, an ecosophy, as I call it, then you'll become an attractor for that if you love what you're doing. As Rumi said, why do you stay in prison when the door is so wide open? And he also said, there are 1,000 ways to kneel and kiss the earth. Find your way, become an attractor, love what you're doing, and make a better world. So everyone out there, happy Earth Day and happy Earth Life.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. Again, this is Nathan Crane with the Panacea Community. This is the Earth Day Summit, produced by the Shift.